Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
Welcome to the Talky Bit. This is part 10 of this series. I've been reflecting a little bit on why this series has ended up having so many parts. And I've come to the perhaps unsurprising conclusion that in no small part, it's because reclaiming one's self from big complex systems is a complicated and difficult thing to do. It can be ambiguous, it can be disorienting, saddening, liberating, scary, so many other feelings, and that is without even considering the social and relational aspects of it and the more sort of stereotypically spiritual aspects of it. There's a lot of layers. So despite the fact that we keep coming back to it in this series, I don't think we've actually done more than just scratch the surface. Now, that could sound like the setup for parts 11 through 20. Goodness knows we could go there. However, I also think it's important to acknowledge that there's no single sort of named topic that's going to be everyone's preferred space or point of access. So perhaps it's reassuring to know that we're nearing the end of this particular exploration, at least as considered through the lens of religious trauma and religious trauma syndrome. So today what I would like to do is consider some thoughts about what we're going to call rebuilding, although perhaps it's helpful to think of it as reconstruction, especially if we've been thinking of all the previous experiences or processes as deconstruction, which is not uncommon language for that stuff. If there's a sequence here that might help us remember something about what we've already considered in terms of stages in this stuff, it might be something like deconstruction, anger, grief, followed by reconstruction. We could also think of it in really sort of umbrella terms as a movement from flight or fight to rest and restoration. That's pretty tidy, too tidy, really. But sometimes that kind of tidiness and naming is what we need to help us have language for these sprawling and hard to define experiences and processes. So what I've chosen to do for this morning, at least, is go with reconstruction, at least for now. I once made the tactical error of watching an entire YouTube video of someone rebuilding an old house. And you know how this goes, right? So some algorithm, you know, sees me do that, right? And in this mysterious calculus of algorithms, it's the, if you like that, you'll like this. It just keeps feeding me things like that, of course. And yes, I do understand that that doesn't mean I have to click on whatever pops up. However, my interest in that original video was authentic. And so the things that pop up are interesting. I do enjoy the process of taking things that are in need of repair and trying to make them better. It's quite possibly one explanation for why we keep living in houses that are, you know, quirky projects. If there's one thing that I've learned from living in and working on these kinds of houses, it's that sometimes, often even, to make something better, or to use the language we're using to reconstruct it, you have to tear it pretty nearly down to the basics. Strip the room to the studs is construction talk for pull everything off the walls, the ceiling, and the floor, and then start the project. It's hard, it's messy, and it's sometimes hazardous, but it does tend to produce a much better result than just slapping a coat of paint over what's there and calling it rebuilt. To stay with the construction metaphors for a moment, one of the things that can make tearing something down to the basics a bit frightening is that You can't be sure what you're going to find inside the walls. And I'm not just talking here about, you know, buried treasure, dead bodies. I'm just talking about, you know, things like bad... you know, you to be clear.
Just
to be clear, we have not found either of those. I'm just talking about, you know, bad wiring and plumbing, like just the stuff houses are made out of, creative framing, right? Foundation. Yeah, that's right. Exact cracks in the foundation. And I think it can be like that with beliefs as well. Like we rip into them, we start deconstructing, and then we get things a bit peeled open and we realize, oh, it's as big a mess inside the structure as it was outside, but now it looks worse because we peeled off the veneer and we can't even live in there until we do some cleanup and some reconstructing. Because now it's just, everything's just a mess. Which means, among other things, that choosing what we're going to work with in the process of reconstruction is complicated. And also, that's all informed by what we imagine the end product might be. Here's one of those points where this metaphor fails, as they all eventually do. Reconstructing a room might have an end point where we stand back from the project and say, well, that's done. Reconstructing what we believe really might not, because beliefs are not static. They're alive and they keep on changing. They're always informed by the stimulus and the context and the material we have to work with. Which is one of the reasons why I think it's so easy to misunderstand what reconstructing beliefs might look like. When we've come from systems of belief that are closed, that are, in my little renovation metaphor, all done, when we come from systems like that, systems that teach us that there is such a thing as right belief and that all other beliefs are categorically wrong or incomplete, it makes sense that we might think that reconstruction means something more like finding a new system of right belief to adhere to. So we might change churches, change denominations, change what books we read, podcasts we listen to, change religions, if it's religion that we're seeking for belief in. And I'm not being dismissive of any of those things. They might all be a very important part of our process and experience. However, when it comes to reconstructing from the sort of harm done by fundamentalist systems of belief, from religious trauma or its related syndromes, we're not talking about slapping on a different coat of paint. We're talking about ripping something down to the studs and starting over. Which is, well, here's why I would say that. As we've considered in this series, in fundamentalist belief systems, we are trained towards passivity and codependence because of the emphasis that is put on external guidance and divine control. If a system teaches us that the only place where I can find the capacity to do or be well, or to find strength, is outside myself, I'm being trained to look outside of myself for security and satisfaction. To put it another way, if I'm being taught that the only one who can save me is God, I'm also being taught that I don't have the agency or resources to help myself. And that is, among other things, a shortcut to addictive tendencies, to depending on what is outside of me to make me feel okay about myself. As an interesting and potentially problematic side effect, it also sets me up to be the perfect consumer, always looking outside of myself for what will make things better. It's out there somewhere. Just got to find it. So we're looking out, not looking in. When I was about 5 years old, my dad taught me the basics of how to use a hammer. I expressed an interest. I mean, he had a hammer. I loved my dad. I admired him. I want to be like dad. So hammer equals dad, you know, right? And also, nice, perfect symbiosis here. He also believed that everyone should know how to use a hammer. So lovely. As you can probably easily imagine, the early results were messy and ineffective and sometimes painful. But a few decades further down the road, I can hammer in a nail pretty well, thank you very much, and I'm pretty comfortable with a hammer in my hand. What was once a skill or a resource that someone else had has become a skill and a resource that I carry with me. I feel like in this space that we're in today, there's a built-in illustration that's very telling to me, which is Tyrion's process for learning how to play jazz when he wasn't trained as a jazz pianist. And he basically... have I told you this story before? Shake your head if I have. Okay. He had studied classical piano. He really liked his instrument, wanted to learn more on the instrument, knew he would never be a concert pianist in the classical realm, said, what's next? That would be jazz. Went to Will Bonas, the head of the jazz department at U of M, and said, Will, it's by audition. I'd like to audition for the program. Will said, have you ever played jazz? Tyrion said, no. Will said, you're crazy. Tyrion, who's a very determined young man, said, "What do I need to do to get ready for the audition?" Will just handed him this massive stack of music and said, "Go learn this." And so Tyrion basically locked himself in the piano room, and like we just, you know, shoved food under the door for the summer. Like almost literally, he just worked on that stuff and got in and did fine. But learning that whole other musical language is quite a journey, right? Because jazz is a different musical language, and you want it to be in you because you want to be able to spontaneously compose. You want to be able to play what you feel when you're improvising. So it's a couple of years ago now, but I called Tyrion after a jazz gig, and I said, "How did it go last night, T?" And he said, "Well, Dad, last night I didn't have to think. I just played." I know the backstory, right? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about reconstruction. Like, we're talking about doing the work until what we're making stops being playing the rudiments and playing the scales and that metaphor and that story and becomes something that is now part of us, that we carry with us. It's ours. I don't have to think about this all the time. Sometimes I can just play. Sometimes I can just live it. It's just in there. And I mention those stories as a way of pointing out that one of the very important early stages of reconstruction is discovering and learning to use our own inner resources. In that metaphor, it's starting to learn the language that is ours about what we believe instead of somebody else's language. It's moving in the Tyrion story from this is a stack of jazz standards that somebody else wrote. These are their voices to these things I carry with me now. They're part of my voice. When I turn that idea into a story about learning how to use a hammer or learning how to play a different musical language, it might sound like it should be, you know, simple but not easy, perhaps a bit of practice and we're good to go, right? But when it comes to beliefs, it's not so straightforward. If we've been taught that we either don't have the inner resources to find our way in the world or that relying on those resources is sinful or might head us down a path that's destructive, that shift from outside to inside can be very, very difficult. For some of us, learning to trust ourselves for the first time might also mean getting in touch with the feelings, with the emotions, with the sensations that live inside our bodies for the first time. And that means steadily, among other things, steadily releasing permission to ourselves to reclaim the right to feel what we feel, including big, powerful emotions like anger and like grief. It's a big shift from you are God's and not your own to you are allowed to connect with and understand your emotions and your intuition is a valid inner resource that can make you fully human and healthy. That's not a little maneuver. One way to give language to what we're doing at this stage is that we're beginning to develop our own autonomous approach to life. For us to truly reconstruct, we have to learn how to assemble our own pattern of meaning, regardless of how long it takes and what it looks like. That's one of the skills. And it's not that unusual to experience things like depression or numbness during a process like this. Like it can really rock us down to our core. It's not that unusual for people who are going through something like this to say things like, "I don't feel alive" during this process. That level of numbness. Pretty powerful descriptive language. When we step away from a former faith story, we're not just tweaking some details. We're stepping away from a meaning-making system. We are stepping away from the way we made sense of our life and the world around us. And when that system has been an authoritarian one, or had aspects of it that worked that way, part of the struggle to find an authentic and healthy spirituality is navigating the fear of getting trapped into an alternative authoritarian environment. We're just going to exchange broken systems. And I think this is one of the reasons why some folks find the table difficult to imagine. Functionally, it has some of the cultural shapes that are the same as the system they might be deconstructing, right? It's on a Sunday morning. It's got someone at the front talking to the group, at least some of the time. Sometimes there's music. You can get a receipt for a tax donation, however you mark these things. If these things were present in a previously harmful system, then their very presence somewhere else points to the harm. Like their existence points to the harm. It's a bit of an aside, and I want to stay in my lane with it, but I think this is also a human reality that's part of what can make decolonizing learning environments, for example, so challenging. If part of the trauma is connected to the environment itself, if you were traumatized, part of your trauma is related to things that happened in a classroom, learning how to heal from trauma by studying it in a classroom really might not be the path forward. right? And when you say it in a sentence, it sort of makes sense. But it's not that easy to discern sometimes. So having said that, it's impossible to navigate life. And you know me, I try to not to use absolute language casually, and I just did. I'm going to stay with it. It's impossible to navigate life without having any meaning, structure, story, or purpose. So it's incredibly important to have this aspect of reconstructing take place, even if it's messy and it takes a long time. We do not do well as a species without a meaning-making story. So if we want to travel the path towards healing and freedom, a path on which we need to learn how to reclaim our feelings, release our emotions, discover an authentic spirituality, and connect that with our inner world, after being told for so long that those things were either off limits or not possible, how might we do that? Well, again, not necessarily a tidy linear system, but there is a stop one, I think, for most of us. And stop one is to seek out spaces, places, relationships that can help us establish a sense of personal safety and belonging. And again, that's not going to look the same for everybody. For some, it might mean something more structured that helps us engage in a trauma healing modality. It might be something therapeutic. For some, it might mean somatic techniques or mindfulness practices, things that help us get in touch with what's going on inside of our bodies and the connection between what our bodies are telling us and what we're feeling, what our emotions are. For others, this might have to do more directly with physical healing, something medical or a combination of those, or something biochemical. For most, this process will benefit from finding a community of people who have either been through the same experience or have some substantial empathy for it, which arguably is where you are if you're at the table. To be clear, I'm not making any sort of universal claims about this community. I think we're clear both about why we exist and what the limits of that why are, which I hope people can find helpful as they sort out where they can best do this work of reconstructing. All right. I can also appreciate how this all might sound a little bit daunting. Some good news, our brains are pretty elastic. Our minds can experience healing by exchanging stories, and our bodies can more or less come along for the ride. And the body part might take some extra care, attention, and support because our bodies uniquely store trauma, but it's possible. If there's a part two here, it's what I so briefly just described as exchanging stories. We can't trade in an old story for a new one until we make space for it, until we basically unlearn the previous one or the old one. I like to think of it like a bookshelf that's already full. I can't put a new book on there if it's full until I take some other books off. And this is particularly true for us as adult learners. Displacement is essential to new learning, and displacement makes us uncomfortable. I know what that book says. I know where to find it. I'm going to put that one in a box? I'm going to give that one away? It's off to Value Village? There's a rub, isn't there? But taking a book off the shelf to make room for a new one is perhaps also another way to imagining things like opening up, like telling our story, like taking back ownership of our own personal narrative, all essential tasks in the reconstruction process. All right, this might seem like a bit of a jump from where we're at, but I think it might also give us a way to wrap this up that both provides some punctuation and also leaves room for further explanation another time or from another vantage point. Our ability as a species to create fiction, to retell the past and to speak of potential futures, to imagine what is not yet real to us, that is arguably what has allowed us to develop into our species in the first place. This is uniquely human activity. These are some of the unique tools that make us human and that equip us to navigate a dynamic and a changing world. When we come up against their limits, we feel it, right? I mean, this week in the news, Manitoba government, we're going to put some policies in place that limit access to certain kinds of social media for kids below a certain age. Arguably, the primary driver for that is that as a species, we're not equipped for that developmentally until later in life. It does us harm if we go too far too soon with it, right? So this is the same kind of thing. So we're going to change the story. We're going to adjust the story making here. We're going to say in the story this society tells about accessing social media, we're going to tell the story that that is unsafe to such a degree that we're going to limit it by law. I'm not advocating for or against this. I'm just sort of describing the process here, right? We're going to limit it by law chronologically, like we do with drinking. like we do with recreational drugs, like we do with driving a car. Can a 12-year-old learn to drive a car? Well, I did. Like, you can. Should we trust a 12-year-old's brain, body, life experience, and skills with something of that actual impact? We decided no. We told the story that way. I can take you tomorrow to farms where they're telling a different story, and their 12-year-olds all know how to drive the grain truck. Right? Okay? So that but we do this. This is how we navigate the world. So it's part of what makes us human. And when we do work like this, that's the kind of work we're doing. Because these things also form the roots, these same skills, these inclinations to story making, to creating fiction about the past and about the present and about the future, they also form the roots of our inclination toward belief and the makings of systems of belief, some of which we call religions. If we can dismantle our former religious dogma by recognizing what is false about it, understanding and validating the ways we've been harmed by it, and by growing into the self-permission to feel safe without it, we can begin to experience release from the grip of broken moral codes that have been imposed on us within those systems. I don't know any shortcuts in that. Communities, friends, family, practitioners can help us find information, help us access opportunities to set ourselves free from abusive religious narratives, support us in entering safe and sacred spaces within ourselves and together with others in which to explore and delight in both our own humanity and what we share with other people. What I've described today really focuses on autonomy, because in the end, a lot of this just starts at home. It does start inside of us. But I hope you've also heard some balancing ideas in here about community. Most of us are familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that triangle, right? It's got all the basics at the bottom, food, shelter, safety, and so on. And as we move up through the development of the human being in their maturation process, at the pinnacle of Maslow's hierarchy is a fully actualized individual. I recently saw an indigenous scholar's version of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and the triangle was upside down. We entered that story as an individual, connected to everything, but as an individual. But when we were fully realized as a human being, what we experienced was communal. And so the fully realized human being was about connection and community. It wasn't about radical individualization. And I thought that was, for me, that was not a little shift, right? And so I hope you've heard some balance in this. Yes, there's this work we uniquely need to do for and with our own interior life. And also, we do it best in connection and in community. That's why we're here as a species. If we have big brains and vulnerable bodies, right? Our young are fully dependent for an awfully long time in the world of mammals. Stick around for foaling season or calving season, and it's minutes, maybe an hour or two, before those little guys are rocker horsing around, you know, right? Not humans. If we hadn't figured out how to do this together, we wouldn't even be here. We wouldn't have survived as a species. And I don't think that suddenly ceases to be true when it comes to making meaning of all of this. We need one another in these processes. And I think when we do this kind of work, one of the things that might happen is, in turn, that can help us to offer some of those same gifts of experience and insight and empathy to others. And that, in turn, I think can help us to make a community in which it is, among other things, safe to explore what we believe, which is what we're here to do. So let's keep doing that. Peace.